Envision this. You are a primary care physician in a busy clinical office when a mother brings her 16-year-old son in because he saw blood in his urine. She shares, "He told me it wasn't a big deal, but you know adolescents, they always downplay things. I think blood in the urine is a big deal." The patient himself is sitting quietly and only answers when pressed, "I feel fine." His mother then chimes in, "He had a sore throat about 2 weeks ago, but I did not bring him to the doctor at that time because he said that he was getting better." On further investigation of the patient's chart, you do not identify any other medical problems, and you note that he has only come to your office for annual physical exams that are required by his school. During today's visit, you observe a blood pressure of 134 over 80 millimeters per mercury and a normal overall physical, with no rashes or edema. To be safe, you send his urine for further analysis, and the report says that red cells and red cell casts are observed. The chemistry that you ordered also reveals an elevated serum creatinine level of 1.4 milligrams per deciliter. Welcome to Audio Bricks. This is Ed Barnes breaking down nephritic syndrome in your ears. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Define nephritic syndrome and indicate which renal diseases most frequently cause it. 2. Review the immunopathology and the pathophysiology of nephritic syndrome. 3. Describe the clinical presentation of nephritic syndrome. 4. Describe the diagnosis and management of nephritic syndrome. Part 1. What is nephritic syndrome? Nephritic syndrome is a group of findings seen in some patients with renal glomerular disease. These patients classically present with red blood cells in the urine, or hematuria, oliguria, which is low urine output, azotemia, which is an elevated blood urea nitrogen and serum creatinine, and hypertension. They also usually have mild to moderate edema, also known as swelling of the lower extremities and or face. And typically, there is a mild to moderate proteinuria, less than 2 grams in a 24-hour period, unlike the heavy proteinuria of nephrotic syndrome. The nephritic and the nephrotic syndromes describe two general patterns of clinical findings that occur in glomerular kidney diseases. They can both be classified as primary to the kidney, like IgA nephropathy, or classified as secondary to systemic illness like lupus or post-infectious glomerular nephritis. But what all these glomerular disorders have in common is that an underlying disease disrupts the normal glomerular structure and function. It sometimes can be difficult to differentiate between the nephritic syndrome and the nephrotic syndrome. If you remember that the hallmark finding of nephritic syndrome is hematuria and the hallmark feature of the nephrotic syndrome is heavy proteinuria, it will be helpful. Here's a brief quiz. What are the classic findings associated with nephritic syndrome? Hematuria, oliguria, azotemia, and hypertension. Part 2. What causes nephritic syndrome? Now, let's dive deeper into some of the different conditions that lead to nephritic syndrome. I will discuss their underlying etiologies and the other organs involved. First, let's discuss a group of diseases that are associated with infections. Let's start with IgA nephropathy. IgA nephropathy is a glomerular disease that usually presents within 2 to 3 days of a viral upper respiratory infection. IgA nephropathy can also present as a renal finding of Henoxylalanine purpura, a systemic disease that presents with purpura, abdominal pain, and joint pain. Next is post-infectious glomerulonephritis, also known as post-strep GN. This is usually caused by a group A strep and staph. The renal manifestations usually arise 2 to 3 weeks after the initial infection. And lastly, we have membranoproliferative GN, not to be confused with membranous glomerulopathy, which is a common cause of nephrotic syndrome. This is caused by hepatitis C and cryoglobulinemia. You should look for jaundice and signs of liver disease. Now, Let's transition to a systemic disease that leads to multi-system dysfunction. Lupus nephritis, which is, of course, also associated with systemic lupus. So these patients can present with the classic rash, joint pain, pleuritis, and anemia attributed to systemic lupus. There are also several systemic vasculitides that can lead to nephritic syndrome as well. They usually present with pulmonary symptoms in addition to the nephritic renal findings. Let's dig in a bit deeper to a few of those conditions. First, we have eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. It's a vasculitis that is associated with asthma. These patients usually present with symptoms consistent with asthma, fever, and GI disruption. They can also present with cardiac, eye, neuro, and skin symptoms. Good pastures is another vasculitis that leads to nephritic syndrome. These patients present with hemoptysis, or coughing up blood, and hematuria. And lastly, granulomatosis with polyangiitis presents with hemoptysis and hematuria, but a key differentiator is the sinus involvement. Patients may present with sinus infections and nosebleeds. Let's stop here for another quiz question. Which disease that leads to nephritic syndrome presents 2 to 3 days after a viral upper respiratory infection and is the renal disease that is associated with Henoch-Schönlein purpura? You are right if you said IgA nephropathy. Remember that the infection with IgA nephropathy is just a couple of days prior to the renal presentation, and in post-infectious GN, the renal disease occurs about 2 weeks after the infection. Last note here before we move on. While glomerular kidney diseases are classically generally classified as either nephritic or nephrotic, in practice, there may be considerable overlap. So keep in mind that IgA nephropathy, lupus nephritis, and membranoproliferative GN caused by hepatitis C can all have both nephritic and nephrotic presentations. Part 3. What is the pathophysiology and histology of nephritic syndrome? Nephritic syndrome is a clinical, not a pathologic diagnosis. Within one basic clinical presentation of hematuria and hypertension, the pathophysiology and the histologic appearance have a lot of variability. In practice, if we looked only at the renal histology, we are not always able to determine whether a patient would have nephritic or nephrotic syndrome or both. And we're not able to say how severe their signs and symptoms would be. For example, IgA nephropathy and membranoproliferative GN can be nephritic or nephrotic, yet look very different on pathologic examination. Said another way, we use pathology to identify specific disease, and we don't usually use it to classify it as nephritic or nephrotic or predict the severity. It can be confusing to think about how patients with nephritic syndrome present with hematuria. It is not clear exactly why nephritic patients have hematuria, since the red blood cells are far too large, about 100 times larger than the endothelial cell pores. How do they squeeze through even a damaged glomerular basement membrane? What we observe are dysmorphic RBCs, or misshaped RBCs. The shearing of these RBCs as they make their way through the GBM is what leads to the unique-looking cells in the urine. Sometimes these are described as Mickey Mouse ears. Unfortunately, the true origin of hematuria in nephritic syndrome remains unknown, but it still remains one of the hallmark features of the syndrome. Now, let's discuss two general path characteristics of nephritic diseases, cellular proliferation and immune complex deposition. Let's start with cellular proliferation. The glomerular histology is quite variable in the nephritic diseases, ranging from cellular proliferation to vasculitis, immune complex deposition, and GBM disruption. Most have cellular proliferation at some stage. Proliferative glomerular diseases is characterized by glomerular hypercellularity. The increased cellularity includes an increased number of cells at the base of the glomerular tuft called mesangial cells, or an increase in the cells that line the inner portion of the glomerular capillary, known as the endothelial cells, and the proliferation of the cells that line the inside of Bowman's capsule, named parietal epithelial cells. This hypercellularity also includes migration into the glomerulus of inflammatory cells, such as neutrophils and mononuclear cells. Remember, the term proliferative is referring to the pathologic finding that can be found in several types of diseases that leads to nephritic syndrome. Examples of diseases that lead to proliferative glomerulonephritis include, of course, membranoproliferative, GN, IgA nephropathy, post-streptococcal GN, and lupus nephritis. This cellular proliferation contributes, along with damaged glomerular basement membrane, to the reduced glomerular filtration rate, or GFR, and rising creatinine that are seen in many cases of nephritic syndrome. It can even lead to severe renal failure and oliguria, or falling urine output. It's hypothesized that all that cellular proliferation provides a barrier to fluid passing through the glomerulus, but this is not certain. It cannot be determined from histology which nephritic patients will have oliguria and which ones will not. An important type of proliferation in some nephritic patients, especially those with falling GFR, is the presence of glomerular crescents. Crescents form in the urinary space surrounding the glomerular tuft, also known as Bowman space. These crescents form from layers of proliferating parietal epithelial cells, fibrin, immune globulins, cytokines, and complement proteins that accumulate within the crescents. They also form along the capillary endothelium and around podocytes. Patients with crescents, decreasing GFR, and hematuria are a subset of nephritic patients that are said to have rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis, also known as RPGN. This pattern of injury can be seen in all diseases that lead to nephritic syndrome, in their most aggressive form. With that said, post-infectious GN and vasculitides are among the most common diseases that lead to RPGN. Next, let's talk about immune complex formation or deposition. Immune complexes play an important role in the pathophysiology of nephritic syndrome, just as they do in nephrotic syndrome. The complexes sometimes are trapped as they circulate in the blood, or more often, they form in situ right in the glomerulus as part of the immune response. In nephritic syndrome, the complexes can be anywhere in the glomerulus, often scattered in the mesangial cell matrix, as in lupus nephritis. Critically, the GBM is sometimes disrupted with immune complexes. This is more typical of nephrotic patients, but can be seen in nephritic syndrome as well, like the accounting for the proteinuria seen in some patients. Let's stop here to review with a question. What is a notable histopathological finding common in patients with proteinuria in the nephritic and nephrotic syndromes? Immune complex deposition is a common finding of many nephritic and nephrotic syndromes. In general, immune deposits are more widespread in nephritic syndrome and tend to occur more prominently along the basement membrane in nephrotic syndrome. Part 4. What is the diagnostic workup of nephritic syndrome? When nephritic syndrome is suspected by history or physical exam with findings like edema, hypertension, or maybe even dark urine, the workup begins with a urinalysis, BUN, and creatinine. Hematuria is seen in all cases of nephritic diseases, although normal RBCs can be seen in many renal and non-renal diseases like bleeding coming from the collecting system, the ureter, bladder, or urethra. The dysmorphic or abnormally shaped RBCs are only seen in glomerular diseases because, as stated earlier, these misshaped cells get their unique shape from squeezing through the GBM. Red blood cell casts are also only seen in glomerular disease and strongly suggest nephritic syndrome. An RBC cast is a coalescence of red cells held together by a sticky protein called Tam-Horsfall protein. This sticky material, along with the presence of RBCs in the lumen of the tubule, form a cast of that tubule. What we observe in the urine of nephritic patients are cigar-shaped clumps of RBCs stuck together. Another important part of the evaluation for a patient with nephritic syndrome is the urine protein to creatinine ratio. The amount of proteinuria in nephritic syndrome can vary in amount, but traditionally, it is less than the amount of protein found in nephrotic syndrome. The amount of proteinuria should be quantified with the urine protein to creatinine ratio. Some nephritic diseases like lupus nephritis can present with both nephritic and nephrotic syndrome simultaneously. So, protein quantitation to look for nephrotic syndrome, which is a urine protein to creatinine ratio greater than 3.5, should be done in all patients. There are also several serology studies that might be helpful to determine the cause of nephritic syndrome. While these serology studies can help focus your differential diagnosis for the underlying disease process, renal biopsy is necessary in most cases for a definitive diagnosis. Now let's associate some common serology studies with their counterpart diagnosis. Anti-streptolysin O is found in patients with recent respiratory infection who are at risk for post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. Anti-nuclear antigens are associated with lupus nephritis. Anti-neutrophil cytoplasmic antibodies, or ANCA, are associated with granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Anti-glomerular basement membrane antibodies are found in good pasture syndrome. Elevated serum IgA levels are associated with IgA nephropathy. Finally, hepatitis C or serum cryoglobulins are associated with membranoproliferative GN. Let's stop here to do a quick quiz. Which serologic study would you expect to be positive in a patient that you suspect has post-strep GN? You'd expect a positive anti-streptolysin O, also known as ASO, in a patient that you suspect has post-strep GN. Serum complement levels are another frequent set of lab values used to focus your differential diagnosis for nephritic syndrome. The complement levels are often decreased in post-infectious GN, lupus nephritis, and membranoproliferative GN. Now, as I mentioned a minute ago, to reach a definitive diagnosis and accurately stage disease, renal biopsy is often required. But the procedure has significant risks, such as hemorrhage and even potential kidney loss. This means there should be clear therapeutic implications based on biopsy results, and biopsy should not be performed in patients where the cause of renal disease is obvious and where no further workup for staging is required. For instance, a patient with nephritic syndrome 2 weeks after a strep throat and a positive ASO titer has post-strep GN and would not need a biopsy. Also, a patient with palpable purpura, hematuria, and suspected systemic vasculitis would receive a skin biopsy rather than a renal biopsy. Biopsy is always needed if the serum creatinine is rising rapidly as an RPGN. Let's do a quick stop here for another review question. When is renal biopsy indicated in the workup of nephritic and nephrotic syndrome? Renal biopsy is indicated in nephritic patients when therapy would change based on the results or when the creatinine is increasing rapidly. Part 5. How do we manage nephritic syndrome? Treatment of nephritic syndrome is based on treating the underlying cause. Treatment might include immunosuppressive therapy with prednisone, cyclophosphamide, or other drugs for inflammatory diseases like lupus nephritis or granulomatosis with polyangiitis. In a patient with rising serum creatinine or rapidly progressive GN, corticosteroids are started immediately. Good pasture syndrome, anti-GBM disease, usually requires plasmapheresis to remove the damaging circulating antibodies. In other cases, treatment may be supportive. For example, treatment of post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis is mainly supportive, including fluid restriction, diuretics for severe edema, and blood pressure control with antihypertensive medications. Dialysis may be needed if the GFR falls to very low levels with uremic signs and symptoms like confusion, itching, dyspnea, hyperkalemia, or acidosis. All patients with glomerular disease should receive antihypertensive therapy to control the blood pressure to a goal of less than 130/90 mmHg. Treatment generally includes an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor, or ACE inhibitor, or angiotensin receptor blockers for its effects to lower blood pressure, lower proteinuria, and slow the progression of many glomerular diseases. Be cautious with the use of ACE inhibitors in patients that have very low GFRs or an elevated potassium level. Let's try one last review question. What is the role of steroids in the treatment of nephritic syndrome? Steroids reduce inflammation as well as other immune-mediated processes that contribute to nephritic syndrome. And that brings us to the end of our discussion on nephritic syndrome. Now let's recap to see if we've completed our goals. First, can you list the four main clinical features that define nephritic syndrome? Nephritic syndrome is a group of findings seen in some patients with glomerular disease that presents with hematuria, hypertension, oliguria, and azotemia. Second, can you indicate which diseases most frequently cause nephritic syndrome? Some common diseases that lead to nephritic syndrome include IgA nephropathy, post-infectious or post-strep GN, lupus nephritis, membranoproliferative GN, and the vasculitides like good pastures, eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, and granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Third, can you describe the three key findings of nephritic syndrome observable on kidney biopsy? Cellular proliferation, glomerular crescents, and immune complexes found anywhere in the glomerulus are all immunopathologic findings that might be observed and on the histopathologic samples of patients with nephritic syndrome. Fourth, can you describe the diagnostic approach for nephritic syndrome? Of course, your approach should include a thorough physical examination looking for edema or rashes. Your initial laboratory study should include a urinalysis and a serum BUN and creatinine. Urine microscopy can also be very helpful because you might observe dysmorphic or these abnormally shaped RBCs and RBC casts. Ordering serologic studies might allow you to focus your differential diagnosis. Renal biopsy should be considered only in patients that have a rapid rise in serum creatinine or when the findings would be helpful to guide the management of the disease. And finally, can you broadly describe the management of nephritic syndrome? Treating the underlying cause and supportive therapy are an important part of the management of nephritic syndrome. Corticosteroids, immunosuppressants, and plasmapheresis are all therapeutic interventions that have been used to treat nephritic syndrome. And that's it. Armed with your newfound knowledge on nephritic syndrome, let's get back to that 16-year-old patient from the beginning of this episode. A mother brings her 16-year-old son to your office because he saw blood in his urine 2 weeks after a sore throat. Your examination did not reveal anything out of the ordinary, but your lab investigation reveals RBCs and RBC casts in the urine and an elevated serum creatinine. How will you explain his clinical condition to his mother? You now have a high suspicion for post-strep glomerulonephritis, so you order ASO levels which return positive. You calmly explain to your patient and his mother that he has post-strep glomerulonephritis, a kidney condition that sometimes develops after a strep throat infection. You further explain that post-strep glomerulonephritis tends to get better on its own and you can closely follow up with them in a couple of days. You notice that his mother looks relieved that her son does not need to be rushed to the hospital for admission, but she still looks worried. You ensure that a 48-hour appointment is scheduled so that you can recheck his blood pressure and serum creatinine. Just as the patient is about to leave your office, he finally looks to you to say something. Thanks, Doc. You're all right. And that's it for our show. Make sure you like and subscribe if you like what you hear, and remember, your feedback helps us to improve. You can enjoy the full BRIC experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time.